Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT, thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCB 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 1050 AM Palm Springs.
Welcome back into the House of Mystery, and of course I'm Al Warren on the west side, and on the east side of the country we've got Mr. David Martino.
I am here.
You're here. Okay.
I'm here.
We're all excited today.
So ready to rock.
Ready to rock. We've got a great author, you know, from the UK calling in on the mm-hmm. line, so we'll get right to him. And we're going to talk about his new book. He's primarily, I guess, a historical fiction author, but we'll find out more. So, Mr. Rory Clemens, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me, Al. Nice to meet you.
Yeah, it's a pleasure. Now, before we get into your new book, it's called A Prince and a Spy. Let's talk about some of your history, some of your background. When did you decide that you wanted to be a writer?
I've wanted to be a writer all my life, but I had to earn a living. After my education, then I became a journalist. Back in those days, there didn't seem to be many creative writing courses around. So I thought, how do I learn to be a writer? I'll go and become a journalist. And so that's what I did for a while. And all the while I was trying to write books. And it's quite difficult to write books when you're doing it part-time. But, you know, I had a few which I would hate to see the light of day because they're pretty bad. But all the time I was learning my craft.
Yeah. Yeah, I think we all go through that. You know, you get better each book. So now you're doing historical fiction. What I find interesting is being a journalist, but you are writing the truth. But when you get into historical fiction, does sometimes the truth get in the way?
No, because I use real events in my stories, and I use real characters, but I also use fictional characters. So. It doesn't get in the way. It helps me. You know, I think of, this book is about the death of Prince George, the Duke of Kent. So I said, well, what really might have happened? And that sets my fevered brain working, and I come up with an idea of what might have happened, and it weaves the story around it.
Yeah, it's an interesting story. I love the Nazi time period, and all the different things I don't know if we'll ever know all the real historical aspects of the little details that went on between a lot of these different characters, as we call them, people that were involved. How much do we know about the people involved here? So like Prince George, the brother of the King of England.
Well, he was a fascinating character. You know, he was a very handsome man. He was, you know, I guess he would have been a bit like, you know, the Prince Harry of his day. But he led a quite racy life. I mean, I'm not saying Prince Harry was like him in that way, but that he was very glamorous. That was the point. And he had been in high society during the 20s. He'd led a very scandalous life in those sort of days. He'd had a long-term relationship with a lady called Kiki Preston, who was a drug addict and was very very sort of notorious at the time. He'd also had affairs with men, including probably Noel Coward, and he you know, eventually settled down with Princess Marina of Greece and became very respectable and a very you know, well thought of member of the royal family and of British society.
Oh, so what did the royal family think of him? But by being so scandalous, you know, fooling around with men, women, and doing all these wild things, and an affair with a drug addict, did the royal family try to straighten him out or change him?
I don't know whether it was the royal family straightening him out or whether he straightened himself out. I think his father, George V, was a bit straight-laced, and his wife was, so they might have disapproved, but I haven't got any quotes to that effect from them. So in those days, the royal family were much less involved with the press, shall we say, so they didn't tend to let their feelings be known. But I could imagine they were they did find it a bit difficult and were keen to get him married and settle down.
Yeah. Was he popular in the country? Did the people like him?
I think he was very popular. Yeah, I think he was. And he was in the sort of society pages. As I said, he was a very good-looking guy. And he would have been in all the big clubs in London and at the big events. And then when he settled down, he became a sort of envoy without, you know, any sort of title to go with it, except that he was, you know, a senior royal, and he was sent off to negotiate with Salazar of Portugal to keep Salazar out of the war. Then he was sent off to America to converse with Roosevelt, and they hit it off immediately. They really did like each other, and he helped persuade Roosevelt to support England. He helped to persuade Roosevelt that England wasn't about to be defeated by the Nazis, and they deserved the support of America. And he helped set up the Lend-Lease system, whereby we got a lot of ships and planes from America, which helped us, keep the Nazis from the door. And, you know, he got Roosevelt to be godfather to his little boy. He's still alive there, actually. He's called Prince Michael of Kent, the son who was Roosevelt's godfather.
Wow. How was he set up here now? So you're sort of have this scenario with him and one of his cousins from Germany, Prince Philip. Now, tell us a little bit about Philip.
Philip had a similar background to his English cousin, Prince George, Duke of Kent. Prince Philip had also had a very sort of racy younger days, and was involved with men, including the poet Siegfried Sassoon. But he was married by the time of the war. He was married to Prince Mathilda of Italy, the daughter of the King of Italy, and he had become very close friends with Hitler. That was largely the doing of Goebbels, who met Prince Philip in 1930, persuaded Hitler to meet him, and they hit it off, and he immediately joined the Nazi Party and became a close friend and confidant. He was said to have been one of the few people who had always had access to Hitler, and he often dined with him, and Hitler saw him as a friend, which he didn't have actually many friends who weren't political allies, but he saw him as a friend, somebody he could dine with and chat with. He was an interesting character in that. Funny enough, you read most of the history books, he gets very little mention, but he was important in Hitler's world at the time.
I wonder how he hit it off with Hitler so well. I wonder why they connected, like on what level, what Hitler saw in him that he really liked. I wonder what that was.
It could be that, you know, that he had a bit of an inferiority complex when it came to the aristocracy, Hitler, and was felt maybe flattered that somebody from that the higher aristocracy. You know, Prince Philip was a great grandson of Queen Victoria, as was Prince George of England. It seems possible, but he certainly liked living that sort of high life, Hitler, didn't he? He loved going to Bayreuth and listening to Wagner and hobnobbing it at the opera. You know, he liked all that stuff. Maybe it felt him built up his self-esteem. I don't know.
Yeah, pretty strange. How did Hitler use Prince Philip? Like, was he used in a political way for him?
He was. He had strong connections with Italy through his wife. He was seen as an unofficial negotiator with Mussolini, so he was back and forth with Italy, dealing with the fascists there. And so he would have been, if as I suggested in my story, he wanted to sound out the English about the possibility of doing some sort of treaty and ending the war between the two countries, he's just the sort of guy Hitler would have used. He could have had unofficial, very, very discreet meeting with his English cousin. Because one thing that the British didn't want was anybody to think that they were talking to Nazis, because our allies were Stalin in Russia and America, both of whom would have been appalled to think that England was talking to the Nazis at all. Now, I'm not saying that that's what happened, but I'm saying this is what could have happened, that there could have been this meeting.
Oh, okay. Now, was it a popular idea at the time within England itself, within the people, that they would rather have some sort of settlement or treaty between the two countries than a war? Is that kind of common?
I'm not sure it had been popular, but I think it was widespread that they thought that there might be a deal done, because in 1942, England was doing really badly still. You know, we had been bombed badly. All the cities had been bombed. We hadn't had any great victories over the Nazis. The Nazis were still deeply involved in their war in the East, and didn't, although they'd come to sort of a bit of a halt, it didn't look like they were going to be turned around anytime soon. And America was just in the war, but their assistance hadn't come through. I mean, for instance, you know, I had the OSS, the Office of Strategic Services, being set up in London in summer of 1942. Well, they were really behind at the beginning. They were really slow to get off the ground, because they didn't have a proper secret service. They had individual secret military intelligence, but they didn't have a centralized agency. I've got to say, they got off the ground very, very quickly once they did get going. They ended up a fantastic organization. OSS, known generally as Oh So Sexy, because they were such a glamorous bunch, of guys and girls.
Well, geez, they didn't call me.
Well, they didn't call you to. They didn't want you in it.
No.
I don't know why not.
That doesn't make sense. They think I'd be right in there. Geez.
Yeah, you'd think so.
Yeah. Well,
maybe you just weren't born in time.
I guess so. You know, I'm old, but not that old. But Now, the premise of this book, in a sense, is that these two princes meet and are going to, you know, talk around the area of perhaps the countries at a treaty and all this stuff. But at the same time, I guess Winston Churchill probably would have never endorsed such a treaty, would he have?
He would never have done it. He had one aim in mind, that had to be total, unconditional surrender by the Nazis. He had no other, but there were plenty of other people in England who would have been happy to, don't forget, I mean, we had fascists in this country, and there were fascists in America as well, you know, the Bund, as it was called, but in this country, you know, but in 1939, just before the war started, our fascist leader, Oswald Mosley, had a mass rally of tens of thousands of people, all demanding there be no war with Germany. There was quite a big fascist element here.
Mm. How do you think Hitler would have been with something like that, a treaty? Wouldn't he be sort of the same as Churchill in the way that he wanted to dominate kind of the world? Wasn't that his intention?
Yeah, he always thought he could work with the British. His idea, going back a long way, was that he would leave the British Empire intact, but the British would leave him to rule Europe. And he could have gone along with that. But he would have been the dominant partner anyway, wouldn't he?
Right.
And he might eventually have come to Britain anyway. Well, sorry, I was only joking about letting you get on with your empire. I want it.
Well, yeah, he
had form in that. He told the Russians he was their pals, didn't he?
yeah, even Italy, right? You know.
Yeah.
I don't know if you could trust him very far, but well, that's really interesting. And so, shortly after this meeting in your book, which is your suggestion, but it was shortly after that Prince George actually died in a plane crash. Now, he was with other people in that plane crash. Wasn't there like 12 people or something, and one survived or something like that?
There's 15, and officially one survived. But, you know, unofficially, there might have been another survivor, and there might have been a woman on board that plane. Now, I'm not the first person to suggest that, but you know, there's a lot of mystery around it because it was hushed up. I've got to say, it was hushed up, the whole event, and there was no reason for that crash. So you think, was it sabotage? Because the plane was in perfect working order, had three of the top pilots in the country aboard, including the Duke himself, who was a seasoned pilot, and so there was something very, very fishy about it.
Do we know why it crashed? As in, like, have you been there and you've sort of seen the area? Was there what was the public told the reason for the crash was?
The official reason was pilot error, which was, I think, might have been a bit of a disgrace because it may not have been pilot error, and I'm not sure that it's fair that on that man's memory, the pilot, whose name escapes me right at this moment, but that he was blamed for the crash. I mean, he was very, very experienced. It was a very low hill he crashed into. So there may be another cause which hasn't come out officially, but which I address in A Prince and a Spy.
Right. And you're not going to tell us because that would be the giveaway, wouldn't it?
It might be.
Well, that's all right. That's all right. I mean, that's the secret. That's the intrigue. But you know, we do know that there was one survivor for sure. Did that survivor ever say anything about the crash or give any evidence?
He was immediately hushed up. He was quite badly injured, and he was in hospital that day. And that day, two Secret Service men went along to his bedside and made him sign something, which was obviously the Official Secrets Act, and he was told he must never say a word to anybody about him. I don't know how he signed it, actually, because both his arms were burned, and it must have been bandaged up. So I don't know what he was holding the pen with. But
Yeah. That's another secret. You can't tell us. You have to be in the book. Well, you know. But that's interesting. So would you be suggesting then that Prince George was the target on the plane? It wasn't anybody else.
No, I'd be suggesting that Prince George was the target. You know, there were, if Prince George was talking to the Germans, and I can only believe that if he was talking to Germans, because they wanted, the British wanted to know about German morale, not because they had any intention of doing a deal. But if anyone outside, for a moment, thought that he was talking to them, they would want to kill him, because Stalin definitely wouldn't have wanted England doing a deal with Hitler and freeing up all his divisions from the West to attack him in the East. And nor would I suggest would have America, having, you know, committed themselves to this war on two fronts, you know, in the East and in against Japan and against Germany. They wouldn't have wanted to think that England was looking at all flaky.
Right, right, yeah. So there's a couple of suspects then. And you're not going to tell us who that is either, the winner, the one.
No. But get back to what Stalin would have thought. Stalin was always paranoid. He was always convinced the British were going to do a deal with the Nazis and pull out the war. And he was, that would not have been good for the Soviet Union if that had happened.
Mm. So Stalin was an interesting character. He was really, he didn't really team up with anybody willingly, did he?
No, but he was very glad to, he teamed up with Hitler willingly before the war and split up Poland. But I guess it's funny enough, for such a paranoid man, it's strange that he hadn't realized that Hitler had no intention of keeping the treaty and hadn't prepared his defenses better, because they were taken completely by surprise when the Nazis invaded them in 1941, which is a bit...
Yeah.
Anyway, I don't know why it doesn't sort of ring true. But, you know, he certainly wanted to be, during the wartime anyway, to be friends with Britain and America, because he wanted the equipment from them and he wanted them to open up new fronts to take the pressure off the East.
Mm. So what was the overall thought, you know, or after the crash, was kind of England and the rest of the world upset about Prince George being killed? Was there kind of a big funeral and all that, or what kind of happened after that?
It was very, very quiet. No state funeral or anything like that. Very little was said about it. The royal family weren't going to let anyone think that they thought their loss was any greater than anybody else's, because people were dying in great numbers in the bombing and on the battlefield at the time. Funny enough, including my own uncle died in the in a submarine in 1942, about that time. So, you know, families were losing people, and the royal family couldn't be made to think that they thought themselves above the rest of the population.
Mm.
Also, but there was a feeling, there always has since then, has been a feeling that something was covered up.
Yeah, that I'd imagine there would have been a... So what kind of conspiracies went around then? Did you kind of find out anything about what people were saying, or not really?
I think the conspiracy theories have sort of started after the war. I think, you know, a lot of people grow up not ever having heard of Prince George, the Duke of Kent, which you can't imagine now. You know, if the King's brother or the Queen's sons died now, you can imagine it'd be world news for weeks on end, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
And yet, very little was made of it. But since then, there have been some quite strange conspiracy theories. One is that he was had a Rudolf Hess aboard, you know, Hitler's deputy who fled to England in 1941. And that Rudolf Hess, who was tried at the Nuremberg trial, was a lookalike. It does. I mean, that just simply doesn't make sense.
Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, I mean, well, did Hitler escape? Did he kill himself?
Who knows?
I've heard he's on the moon. I've heard all sorts of stuff, right? Who knows, right? But
one day we might find out. Maybe still alive somewhere.
Yeah, I heard that the aliens took him to the dark side of the moon. He's on a base, and he's going to come back. But, you know, he's going to be pretty old.
He's going to be pretty old. Yeah. He's probably got Stalin and Mao Zedong there with him as well.
Elvis Presley's playing music for him.
And Elvis will be there.
Yeah, it's all there. This is a book two of a spy novel that series kind of you're doing, right?
It is part of a series, yeah. There have been other ones printed in Britain, but they haven't come out in America yet.
Okay.
Who knows? And there's a new one on the way in England in January, so hopefully it'll come out in America as well. I think Pegasus has done a great job publishing in America. I'm really pleased with it.
Yeah.
A great bunch of guys.
Yeah, they get out there. But now, so you have a character called Professor Tom Wilde in this, right?
Yeah.
Now
he's half American and he's half Irish, and he looks upon those sort of slightly effete upper class people who inhabited places like Oxford and Cambridge University back in those days. You know, you didn't get into Oxford or Cambridge in those days on how clever you were, it was which school you went to. But they were very good at university at the same time, but it was a different world.
Right.
And there weren't many women around in those, they were sort of like boys clubs. In fact, you know, women at Cambridge weren't allowed to get degrees until 1948, which is shocking because actually there were some women, there were two women's colleges and there were some fantastic women came out of them. They weren't allowed to actually get a degree, however much cleverer than the boys they were.
Yeah. Well, they didn't have Oprah back then either, so they, you know, they wouldn't get advertised, you know, as much. So, how much research goes into something like this when you're doing a book like this? How long does it take you to kind of get it all done?
Well, I guess half the time is research, and they are research heavy books. I do like to get my historical facts as accurate as I possibly can, and so I go to great depths. I don't just sort of look in Wikipedia and see what's there. I read around it. I buy.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. and they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
I read hundreds of books and, you know, when necessary, talk to people, you know, who might know, you know, expertise. I mean, one of my books was called Nucleus and involved the splitting of the atom. So I had to sort of make sure I got that that science right. I go to great lengths of to research. I guess half the time is research, half the time is writing. I like the research, so I always like to go to places mentioned in the books when I can get there. It hasn't been easy in the last year.
No, I guess not. Do you get something when you go to a location that something happened, or a place or a castle, or when you're in an area, do you kind of get a feeling for the place and that helps you write it?
You do, and sometimes it's what's not there. I mean, you might, you know, I went to one of my previous novels. It's set in the 16th century. I was writing about a battle in Western France, in Brittany, and I went there just to see this castle which was besieged, and the castle's not there. But I understood the terrain, and so I understood what had happened, even though nothing existed there anymore. I could find out where it had been, and it gives you. It's always nice to go to places, anyway, isn't it?
Yeah,
it gives you a good excuse for going.
Yeah,
it gives you a good excuse to go there. You can always claim your own expenses.
I was going to say it's a good write-off. it's a good write-off. You know, why not? Go for it. You know,
I'm just trying to work out whether Tom Wilde can go to the West Indies in one of my books.
Would you find the time period and the setting actually become a character in the book?
The time period, yeah. Yes, I think that's accurate. I think it's a big part of it, and you've got to get the language right, and you've got to make it of the time. It's a big part of it. The period, it helps in some ways. You know, if you go to historical novels, the technology is pretty straightforward. You know, in the 1930s, 1940s, the only way of communicating really was by telegram or telephone. So, you know, you didn't have. It must get. You know, nowadays, technology is out of date within a year, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's true.
Yeah. I wonder then what do you find the biggest challenge to writing a period piece like that?
The initial thing is getting the language right. You've got to write it so that it doesn't jar you and say, oh, people didn't speak like that in those days. But at the same time, you've got to write it for a modern audience. That was particularly true, you know, when my Tudor novels, you've got to get that. You can't talk in sick Shakespearean English because nobody was going to read it.
Yeah,
but you can't write words, modern words, which jar and you think, oh, you know, they wouldn't have. That doesn't sound like a Tudor voice. So you've got to make it. You've got to find a fine line, a compromise, and it's more subtle probably with the 1930s. I mean, we all understand what is talked about in the 1930s, but some of the language might have jarred. Some of the things that the way they talked.
Yeah. You know, slang expressions, I guess, things like that, right? You know?
Yeah. I think there would have been far less swearing in those days, far less bad language, wouldn't there?
Yeah.
It would have been that, you know, it would obviously always there, but you know, I don't, you know, my parents and grandparents, I don't remember them ever using bad language.
Yeah. Well, I think they wouldn't use it around kids or, you know, certainly. I think there'd be a little bit of discipline, maybe.
I think that's true, yeah. And I would never have used it around them because...
Oh, no, you'd get beat.
Yeah.
I, you know, it's a free-for-all now, but... Did you come across anything unexpected? Like when you're doing research and you're going through and you're reading and you're going to places and stuff like that, is there sometimes you come across something that you had no idea happened?
All the time. I mean, all the time I come across things that surprise me. You know, just little vignettes, little details of history. And you find that there are so many different stories. From the Second World War, there were so many untold stories. I'm trying to think of one on the top of my head right now, but all the time I'm finding things. I mean, just the fact of who we're talking about, you know, Prince Philip von Hessen. I came across him in a book, and I'd never heard of him, so I looked at, you know, I've got dozens of books about the Nazis, and I found about one or two tiny references to him. And yet, masses have written about Hitler's other friend, Speer, but nothing, almost nothing is written about this man, who was actually a very important part of the court of Adolf Hitler.
Huh.
So that was a surprise to me.
I wonder why that that happened. I wonder why he would be left out like that.
I don't know. People just disappear, don't they?
Yeah.
And he ended up surviving it. He was sent off, you know, he fell from grace, and he was sent off to a concentration camp, and his wife was also sent to a concentration camp. She was killed in an Allied bombing raid before the World War, but he survived, and he sort of fell foul of the denazification people, and I think he spent a bit of time in jail, but then spent the rest of his life collecting paintings, traveling back and forth to Italy.
Nice. He had a good long life.
He got away with it.
Yeah, I know, and that's frustrating for a lot of people. I think that
there were a lot of the aristocracy in Germany did join the Nazi Party. It's surprising, I think, a high proportion of them, and I think they sort of saw the Nazi Party as a bulwark against the communists in the East, who were going to come and take their lands away from them and hand it over to the common people. And so they saw the Nazi Party as protecting them against communism. Wow. I'm not sure they actually believed in Nazism necessarily, but they thought better of two evils. They thought they weren't right. They tended to lose their lives and their lands in the end anyway, didn't they?
Yeah. So yourself, do you read a lot of historical fiction? Do you kind of get into some of the authors that do the same type of work, or do you stay away from that?
I read a lot of history. I don't read so much historical fiction. I mean, simply because I don't have enough time. Funnily enough, I'm reading a historical fiction book at the moment. It's not a thriller. It's A Gentleman in Moscow. I don't know if you've heard of it. Amor Towles. I would highly recommend it to anyone. It's just a wonderful book about this guy who, this count in 1922, sort of survived the revolution, and he's holed up in a hotel. I mean, I haven't finished it yet, so I can't tell you what happens, but it's a great read. It's written by an American guy. Yeah, it's really good.
Wow, yeah. No, I'll look for it. Did you have an inspiration that made you write this book, or something that you fell into? Like, what made you follow this story and decide to write a book about it?
Well, I'm always fascinated by the story. I've known the story of, unlike many people who have never heard of Prince George, the Duke of Kent, I've known about it for a long, long time and fascinated by it. And, you know, as a journalist in the old days, you're sort of thinking, what's behind this story? What's behind this story? What's the truth? And, you know, you can't write always what you might think have happened. as a journalist, but as a fiction writer, you can play with it a bit and you can think, yeah, this could have happened. This makes sense. This is feasible. And that's sort of how it came about. And I sort of put it up to my publisher. They liked the idea. And I went for it.
Wow. So has the CIA or anybody come after you? Or
they haven't caught me yet. But okay. Who knows?
Yeah. They'll be watching you. Now, Thomas Wilde, how do you describe him? Like, who inspired you to create that character? Was that it's part of yourself, or was there sort of some real figures in the world that you kind of...
I guess there's always a bit of what you'd like to be rather than what you actually are. You know, I would like to be that brave. I would like to be that useful to the world. But actually, there were two. He is... there are two Americans who inspired me. One was Conyers Reed. I don't know if you've heard of him. He was an author. He wrote a history of the Tudor spy master Walsingham. He was also studied in England, and he was one of the founders of the OSS. And he was also involved in the early CIA. And the other one was James Jesus Angleton, who you may have heard of. He also was involved in, he went to school in England, but he was also one of the, helped set up the CIA and in fact became director of counterintelligence. So it's a couple of Americans who got very strong links with England who inspired me to write, you know, had this American with very strong links to England in Tom Wilde. And both of them, you know, were academics. You know, James Easton Angleton is also a poet as well as a spy. And they, anyway, that's where it came from. Those two guys and probably a bit of me or what I would like to be. But I don't drink as much whiskey as Tom Wilde. Day. I drink a bit more red wine. Me, I can't take the whiskey with him.
But the brave parts. That's all you, right?
The wish for bravery. Because I come from a family of. You look at my website, you'll see some old pictures of my family who were soldiers. You know, my great grandfather was a soldier. My grandfather was a soldier. And my father was in the Navy, as were his two brothers. You know, one of them worked alongside Ian Fleming, you know, the James Bond author in Naval Intelligence. So I've got the history there. I just haven't done it myself. I've never been in the military.
Well, that's pretty funny. So what's next? What do you got coming up after this?
The next one in this series is called The Man in the Bunker, and that's coming out in England in January. Hopefully it will follow soon after in America, but that's for Pegasus to decide, my American publisher. That's sort of set a little while later than The Prince and the Spy. And I've got, after that, I've got three more books just being commissioned by my English publisher, so hopefully they might head off to America as well. Always in hope for that.
Yeah, that's always a good thing, you know. Get it around and stuff. What kind of response do you get from people when you actually are when they find out you're researching something like this, especially something with the Nazi time period?
I think people are pretty open-minded about it. You know, I hope I'm making it clear that it's this is purely for the purposes of a thriller. I mean, I'm not going to go in there into any sort of discussions with people with any sort of political feeling to it. That's not what I'm about. This is me writing as part of the, you know, as allies versus an evil empire. And, you know, I think people understand that. People help me. I get a lot of help from people. You know, I get help from all sides, really. I mean, Germans have helped me, Jews have helped me. People are fantastic. You know, people want to talk generally.
Yeah, it's a good thing. It is. I just wonder now. Do you ever have a subtext or an underlying idea behind a story like this?
I don't know if you call it an underlying subtext, but I mean, in A Princeton Spy, one of the main aspects of it is the people trying to get word out about the Holocaust. They saw it happening in 1942. That's when it really started. I mean, of course, there have been great atrocities before that. We know that. But in 1942 is when they set up the death camps in Treblinka and Sobibor and Auschwitz. And there were people trying to get word out. Some very, very brave people. And that's what that is the focus of what's happening in my book. Britain and America did hear about the Holocaust in 1942, which is 3 years before the end of the war, which is when most people think they found out about what was happening in these camps. They knew about it in 1942. The problem was they couldn't do anything about it. And that's why it wasn't publicized that much, because it would have made them look helpless, I suppose, which they were. I mean, there were people in Poland were desperate for the Allies to bomb these camps. They thought it was better to bomb them and bomb the train lines taking people to them than that they should be left to carry on their evil work.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's the subtext, if you like, but it's not really a subtext. It's sort of quite central to the whole story.
Right, right. It must be strange. It certainly is to me to see the people that are out there denying the Holocaust even ever happened.
Well, nowadays,
yeah,
it doesn't make sense, does it?
Yeah,
I mean, you know, that's why Eisenhower insisted on going into. I'm not sure which camp he was. Was it Buchenwald? He visited, and he went in and he saw all the bodies. He said, "I've got to go in here because I've got to be able to tell the world. Because will come a time when people deny this happened, and I want to be able to say this happened." And he knew it happened. And it happened. So the Holocaust denial started straight after the war. Actually, there were people start saying, "Oh, it's all lies put about. It wasn't anywhere near as bad as that. All the damage was these camps was caused by the Allied bombing." I mean, there were people saying that straight away.
Man, it's just crazy to see the way things go. The history and stuff and that and even with the COVID now and stuff, and see how people almost want to deny it,
yeah, but a lot of people get it. I mean, my daughter's just had it, she's okay fortunately, but other friends of ours have had it and haven't done well.
Yes,
I mean, I don't know why they deny it. They must see it around them.
Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of a craziness going on, but interesting. So, and who would be your favorite writer?
My favorite writer of fiction.
Yeah.
Of thrillers, and one of my favorite ones is William Goldman. Actually, I think he's fantastic. Fantastic writer, Marathon Man, that's one of my all-time favorite thrillers. Freddie Forsyth, The Day of the Jackal and The Odessa File. There's been some... James Ellroy, he's really good. I mean, there have been some great writers. There's an awful lot of ones... I do read a lot of thrillers, and a lot of them... I think they're not as good, but there are some really, really good ones out there. As a kid, I always loved James Bond books, I've got to say.
Yeah.
They looked a bit... I tried reading one again recently. It looked a bit dated. It wasn't quite as thrilling as I remembered it. I think I was really keen on the fantastic covers they had on the books, actually, more than anything in those days.
Well, that's when it happens, you know. The covers will sell, yeah. You know. It's
they do. They were great covers, weren't they? Raymond Chandler, he was good. Robert Harris, I like at the moment. Yeah, some good writers around. I mean, those are thrillers. Of course, I've read plenty of non-thrillers as well, but I am a thriller-loving guy, got to say.
So in the same vein, do you have any influences, whether it's film or writers or anything that might surprise fans?
I guess, when I was a teenager, I'd really, really like romantic women's fiction. I'm talking about historical fiction. I don't know if you've ever heard of a book called about Anya Seton's book, Catherine, but that was a great English bit of historical fiction. It must have seemed very strange to people who knew me to see me reading, devouring these historical novels written by women. But I did like them. I also like Jane Fonda as well. And I like comics too. I always like comics. I think comics are really good because they in a very few words, they've got to tell a story. And I like that. You know, you've got to, you don't hang around. You get straight down to the story, don't you? The action.
Yeah.
If I've read a couple of pages of a book and it hasn't interested me, I'm not going to stick with it. I've got to get, they've got to catch my interest straight away. And I try and do that with my books. I want to catch the reader's interest straight away and hold it.
Yeah. That's true. So now, how do people get a hold of you? You have a website or a location that you like to connect with your fans?
I've got a website, RoryClements.com, or RoryClements.co.uk, same thing. I've got a readers club that you can join and get messages through. I've got to get a link up there so people can email me, but they can certainly get into my readers club, and that's a very, very easygoing affair, which has got a few thousand members, and I just, every now and then, I just let them know what's going on with my research or a new book coming out. I don't bombard you every week or even every month with information.
Oh, too bad. Like more emails, you know. Yeah. I have this one question. Do you think that the history of that time period over the Nazi regime and all the things that went on, do you think it's portrayed quite well in Hollywood, so to speak, in movies and series that you see around?
It can be, yeah. I mean, I think that probably one of the greatest films ever made was Schindler's List, wasn't it? I mean, I went to watch that at the cinema when it first came out, and it's about 4 hours long, isn't it, I think?
Yeah.
I think it's a very, very long film, and I sat in the cinema, and you couldn't hear anything. The audience were absolutely silent from the word go. There was no, you didn't hear a cough, nothing. It held the audience right from the word go, and was an incredible bit of filmmaking, I thought. And he's done other great work. I like Saving Private Ryan and Ryan, that battle scene on the beaches of Normandy is incredible.
Yeah.
I've got to say I do have a soft spot for Quentin Tarantino and Inglourious Basterds, or however you pronounce it.
I did
like that.
Yeah.
I really did.
Yeah. I think he does well, you know. It's
It's
certainly an interesting time period, and I'm sure there's more stories to come, you know, from it. And do you plan on staying in this area for a while?
I think there are as many stories as there are people in the world, aren't there, from the world.
Yeah.
Everyone has a story.
Yeah. I wonder, do you think that do you think people today are growing distant to the war, World War II, and don't really know what went on in the younger generations, do you think?
Well, I don't know. I mean, my publisher has had a book called The Tattooist of Auschwitz. I don't know if you've heard of that, but that sold millions around the world, and it's done fantastically well. So you'd think that there must be still a fascination by it, because they were, they were uniquely evil, weren't they, the Nazis? There have been plenty of massacres and Holocaust around the world, but there was something uniquely deranged about the Nazis, it's been talked about Hitler's dark charisma, but he was charismatic. Women loved him. He was elected because he got the women's vote, because the women had the vote in Germany for a long time by then, and there were far more women in Germany in 1930 than there were men, because so many men had died in the war, First World War. So he absolutely was adored by women. Really strange, that glamour, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. The power, I guess.
He didn't exactly look like a movie star either, did he? He didn't look like Brad Pitt or anything.
No, and I heard he had bad gas and was vegetarian. So.
That's true. Yeah.
Yeah.
He was a veggie.
Yeah. Well, there you go. So, yeah. I don't know. He was the idol of the ladies back then, I guess. So.
He was. Mm. Yeah.
Well, this has been a great interview. We love talking about history, and we had an expert. Today we've been featuring the book A Prince and a Spy, and it's a novel. And our guest has been the author, Rory Clements. Thank you for taking the time to talk to us today.
My pleasure, Al. Thank you.
Thanks, Rory.
Tired of wasting time trying to decide what to watch on your streaming service? Go to our website and look for the Martino Movie Reviews.
To find out more about our show, guests, or to listen to past shows from our archive, please go to www.houseofmysteryradio.com.
Has been completed.
The end!
By George, he's got it! It is the end!
I'll see you.
If you're lying to me, I'll be back.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show is over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.